Hello, everybody, and welcome to Across the Spectrum, the podcast that takes place alongside the Global Spectrum Series, which is the world's largest collection of regional spectrum policy conferences. Now, for this edition of the podcast, we're delighted to bring you a fireside chat that was recorded live at the Americas edition of the conference, which took place in Washington, D.C. just last week. The fireside chat brought together Jessica Rosenworcel, chairwoman at the FCC, and Alan Davidson, Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Communications and Information and Administrator at the NTIA. And we were honoured that this was actually the first time that the two of them had shared a platform in this way since the Assistant Secretary took up his role earlier this year. The conversation was led by Rob Yates from LYA Associates, and it really was a fascinating discussion and one that we're delighted to now have the chance to share with you in full. Before we get started, however, I just wanted to remind you that you can find more information on this conference and all the events that take place as part of the Global Spectrum Series via the website www.spectrum-series.com. We have the regional conferences taking place in both Sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America coming up over the course of the next few weeks before the end of the year, so please do check those out. But for now, I really do hope you enjoy the discussion, and we'll pass over to Rob.
Good morning, everyone. It's great to be here, and good to see everyone. I'm sure you're all familiar with the two panelists, and I'm Rob Yates from LYA. We've been sponsoring this conference for, I think, most of the 11 years it's been on. We've been providing expert consulting services to the industry since 1993, often focused on spectrum management stuff and auctions, spectrum strategy, and related policy and regulatory. Clearly, spectrum management is a very complex subject, and so we're having a fireside chat here. We don't have the fire, and it's set up as a panel, but we'll try to be relaxed and let the two speakers talk to each other. One constant in spectrum management, of course, is there's always a need for more, so it's like as soon as we get a band out there and auctioned, you know, we're always talking about the next one. As one of our clients used to say, you know, I never met a Hertz I didn't like. So that was to warm up the audience. So, all right. So I'm very pleased and very honored this morning to be moderating this session and a fireside chat with two of the industry's most leading players and most important right now, that's for sure. And so we'll give them each a chance to do a few minutes of introductory remarks, and then we'll just turn it into a conversation and see where it goes. So we'll hear briefly from each and then dive into the weeds. So Chairwoman Rosenworcel first.
Well, thank you for having me. I am still excited by and charmed by the fact that we're all gathered here in person today.
Yes.
I'm also excited to be with my colleague and my friend, Alan, and I think it bodes well that the two of us have known each other for decades, and I think that is immeasurably helping our efforts to navigate broadband and spectrum policy in the days and weeks ahead. You know, as we were gathering here, I was just noticing it's the 11th anniversary of the first time that this conference was held, and that was 2011. The math's not hard. And in 2011, that was before Congress passed the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act. In other words, if we were all sitting here in 2011, it was highly likely that we were talking about whether or not Congress would give the FCC authority to do something creative with spectrum policy and hold an incentive auction, the first of its kind in the world. We were probably also talking about whether or not the FCC had the ability to run that auction, and then probably also asking whether or not it would be successful. And I think the most striking thing is the answer to all three of those things is yes, and it's a good reminder that it takes being creative to be successful in spectrum policy, and I'm thinking as we move ahead, it's gonna take creativity and coordination, and I'm looking forward to talking some more about that today, and also looking forward to continuing to work with my friend and colleague, Alan.
All right.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you for gathering us. It's great to be here, and thanks to the chairwoman for joining me on this panel and being here together. And as she said, it has been great that we have known each other. You want to say decades, really?
I don't know.
I think
it feels like a long time.
We were teenagers at the time.
Yeah, that's right. That's
yes, right. But we'll go with that. And it's true. Has the advantage of being true. I am relatively new to this job. Started in January. And, one of the, it is a historic and exciting time at NTIA. We have some very big things on our plate. Love to talk about broadband and our internet for all efforts for sure. But of course, Spectrum has long been a major part of the responsibilities at NTIA and a huge part of our agenda going forward. And I will say a word that you're going to hear a lot in the next half hour or so is coordination. From the very beginning, from the outset, it was clear to me, and I think clear to us, that improved coordination among the federal agencies, and particularly between the FCC and NTIA, is pretty essential for our success here. I was very lucky because my first day on the job, Chairwoman and I spoke on the phone, and we have been in regular contact ever since. And I think we both feel, I certainly feel that the kinds of confidence-building measures that we've been trying to put in place to show the truth of it, which is that we are working together very closely and our teams are working together very closely, and that's an important part of moving forward together on the big issues that we have to tackle ahead of us on federal spectrum usage, on how we continue to make sure that we have the best and strongest, most competitive wireless industry in the world. And we're committed to that. I'm committed to working with the FCC, and it's great to be here today to talk about it.
So you started by mentioning the Memorandum of Understanding, so I'll just go there.
Fine.
I'll save you the question.
That's absolutely the first topic we wanted to go through.
Yeah. It had been 2 decades since the FCC and NTIA signed a Memorandum of Understanding. I mean, 2 decades ago, I'm trying to imagine, I think that I wanted one of those StarTAC phones that flipped and smacked shut, you know, that really satisfying clam shape. Anyway, it's a long time ago in spectrum policy. And it occurred to the two of us that we should really update that effort. And this August, we did that. I think most noteworthy is that we have more regular meetings, that we do more long-term planning, and we've expanded the scope of our coordination to include things like spectrum relocation, but also spectrum adjacencies and other federal interests that may be impacted when we make new decisions about wireless policy. So I think that that Memorandum of Understanding is a public statement of our commitment to coordinate and a recognition that it's really valuable for these kind of documents and commitments to be updated over time.
You know, I'll just say, and it actually started a little earlier because in that first phone call and in those first couple of weeks that I was on the job this winter, we first started with something that I will give the chairwoman credit for as her brainchild, our Spectrum Coordination Initiative, which was an out-of-the-gate showing that we were going to work together and try and do some of these things. And we had a list of things that were on our to-do list, starting with just very regular meetings, monthly meetings, working on some big projects, including the MOU, this MOU that the chairwoman just spoke to. I have to say I was a little skeptical, like, could we actually pull this off in a couple of months? It seemed complicated. The team sort of was a little, you know, like, we have issues here. And the chairwoman was very clear that she thought that this was long overdue.
I think I was tenacious, actually, yes.
Tenacious. She persisted. I think, I give her credit. She said that, you know, this was something that was long overdue and that it shouldn't be that hard for us to get it across the finish line. So we pushed, and I'm so pleased because I think this is an important milestone for us at the end of July, putting out a revised memorandum. And these issues are important because they really get to how we, as the chairman was just saying, how we coordinate, but also how we include, for example, our sister federal agencies, and make sure, I know that there's a lot of interest, I certainly hear it all the time, in having more awareness, more time, you know, greater visibility on some of the big issues that are coming down the pike from the FCC, for example. And so having this down and revised and updated, we're optimistic this is going to help. And these are incremental measures. They don't solve every problem overnight. But these are the kinds of both confidence-building measures that are important, and I think on the ground they will make a difference in this, you know, this hard work of coordination.
No, that makes sense. And I guess there's a lot of other, I mean, there's obviously a lot of detail in these, in this MOU compared to the old one, and a lot of different wording. I don't know if there's some other, like you mentioned, you know, the other federal agencies and things, but when we say, you know, some of the new words, you know, increase in commercial and federal access, the previous one only referred to commercial, We're talking about engineering collaboration for best practices, which I don't think was in the original one. So what's some of the subtleties around that? I guess there's federal agencies coordination, but there's also, isn't there, does it relate to license, unlicensed, right? The satellite, terrestrial, as well as federal versus commercial? Is there other dimensions to that?
I think this was an effort to really show the how things have changed over 20 years. And so, for example, the emphasis, I mean, federal usage is extremely important as well. The same trends that are driving the demand for commercial usage are also driving the use, the demand on the federal side, increasing access to data, increased networking. Innovative use is happening at the federal level by agencies in very mission critical areas. War fighting, aviation safety, climate change research. And we wanted to make sure that we spoke to those new realities in the MOU. And that's where I think why you're seeing more of those words. I think you're also seeing some reflection of, again, the greater importance and of these issues for for the community, the federal user community. And that was why, you know, things like these timelines and the question of adjacencies are were really important to the user community that we were speaking to.
Okay, makes sense. The I guess the other another element of this is how this segues into sort of the roadmap and the new bands, and I guess and maybe the you mentioned about the is the U.S. perceived as being behind, for example, in mid-band. I guess the sort of the mid-band space race, and I, there's a lot of numbers that fly around out there. But when I add them up, I mean, we kind of look similar or the same. I mean, the you know, in Europe, they're talking about like 400 megahertz to be shared amongst people. So you take that into account, and it's actually a lot less that's dedicated to licensed. Where, you know, in the U.S., we've allocated all of the Wi-Fi to unlicensed, but 6 gigahertz Wi-Fi to unlicensed, which, you know, increases dramatically the amount of Wi-Fi. Are we there, or is it really important to get out there? Like I said earlier, you know, we're always looking for the next band, but where do you see us relative to the world there?
Yeah, I think when I took the helm at the agency, we looked back and we realized that we had spent a lot of time on millimeter wave spectrum.
Right.
We had brought a lot of those bands to market, and the reality is that the propagation of those bands is limited, and the ability to use those bands to ubiquitously serve the United States is challenging. Mm-hmm. We noticed that the rest of the world had decided to spend the bulk of their early 5G energies on mid-band, and we had to change course. And so very swiftly, out of the gate, we set up an auction for the 3.45 to 3.55 gigahertz band. You knew we were going to get to all the numbers at some point.
and then draw those numbers, but.
We just concluded an auction in the 2.5 gigahertz band. And I think that that pivot to mid-band is really important because I think it put the United States in a much stronger position. Mm-hmm. And by stronger position, I mean more likely to see 5G deployments all across the country, not just in our most urban communities, and more likely to see those deployments in a cost-effective way. So I think those two swift auctions on mid-band are important. I think it's true what you say, though. We're going to have to identify more airwaves for both licensed and unlicensed purposes. And I know that Alan and his team is doing a lot of work right now on taking a look at the 3.1 to 3.45 gigahertz bands. I don't know if you want to start there.
Yeah,
we can throw other numbers out, too.
People love numbers. I'd say yes, we are, amen to what Jessica just said, and also we are very focused on the opportunities in the lower 3 gigahertz, 3.1 to 3.45. It's a very active area of discussion right now. We believe that there are huge opportunities here, and it's really the next, I think, tranche that we can really focus on, working very closely with our colleagues at the Department of Defense and other federal agencies to look at opportunities and challenges in the space. But we really do believe this is a huge opportunity. We should be thinking creatively about how to use that very, very potentially valuable swath of spectrum. And I just think it's an opportunity too big to pass up. So the next few years, this is our big focus, I think. There will be other things too, and it's not all our eggs in that basket, because we need to make sure that we've got a robust pipeline, and that speaks a little bit to ultimately having a spectrum strategy, a national spectrum strategy that we can work on together, and that gives us more of a roadmap.
And I also want to acknowledge in talking about looking forward to 6G, which feels out there, but other nations are doing it, and I don't think we should be left behind. I have drawn attention to the 7 to 16 gigahertz bands. I think those are prime. And we should right now be looking at ways to see how we can facilitate bringing some of those airwaves to market.
I'll echo that and second that. And it's amazing that it's not too early to be talking about 6G, but it's not. And we are hearing that already from industry and in talking to some of our international partners as well. So people are already focused on it. So we can't take our eyes off the prize right now, but we do need to be thinking ahead. And that's where, you know, strategy ultimately will help us.
Yeah, and also beyond just talking about bands with respect to 6G, we rechartered the Technological Advisory Council at the FCC to specifically focus on 6G. I think when we look across the board at technology, when we see about demand for chips, the security of network equipment, global standardization, what we see is those who plan early do better. So I think that our commitment to 6G work in the Technological Advisory Council is really important right now.
Yeah, I was going to head to the 6G point, and I think it's important because we are, there is a lot of technology development around that, you know, immersive reality and these kind of things, which are going to make, you know, there's a massive need for bandwidth in those. So I guess if we kind of couple that with the roadmap and the future spectrum, where do we see the large swaths, I guess? Are we going to be able to get a huge amount of spectrum in one of these, you know, 4, 7, 9, 11, you know, the different bands?
Well, the way I see it at the FCC, we can start studying what dockets we have open, what petitions we have before us, and try to offer up to our colleagues at NTIA kind of a buffet of opportunities. I mean, we certainly have open proceedings or petitions or investigations into things like the 4 gigahertz band, the 7 and 8 gigahertz band. We also have the 10 gigahertz band and 14 gigahertz band. So we're combing through what we have before us. And my hope is that we can turn to NTIA and offer these opportunities and identify what's feasible and how fast we can make it feasible.
And I will just add, you know, we're in a situation, of course, where the green fields are gone. And every allocation, every potential use means dealing with an incumbent use. And so making sure that we have, as one of our colleagues from OSTP said last week, transparent and predictable processes in place for having those conversations and thinking it through, and that we're using really evidence-based, science-based processes to do it, I think is critical here as we look to identify, because we know we do need to find those opportunities. I'm really excited about some of the ways that NTIA can contribute, not just in helping the federal community work through this, but through our ITS lab, Institute for Telecommunication Sciences, out in Boulder. I see our acting director over here. Who will be speaking later on a panel. I'm excited about our opportunity to use research and increased understanding around science to help us as we do these investigations. And the last thing I would say is, this is echoing something that Jessica has said, is what's super interesting in many ways is how usage is changing in the commercial sector. And I think it was you, Jessica, who said, like, this will not be the maybe most important device when we think about our wireless future.
Yeah, I mean, if we're successful, our phones should be the least interesting part of our wireless future. And it's hard for most of us to grasp that, because most of the time we are actually grasping a phone. And, you know, everyone here has at least one or two devices. And if you don't, you're probably not listening to me and you're wondering where you left it.
I'm still learning to use my watch, which is buzzing right now.
Right.
But yeah, right.
But I mean, think of a world around us with sensors connecting, keeping us with this like steady stream of information that makes us more efficient and effective in everything we do, that helps us manage scarce resources. All of those things are viable. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to really push ourselves, and this includes at the FCC, to think about our wireless future in a way that is not wholly phone-centric.
Sure.
Because that's where the most interesting innovations are going to come. And I think that we have to chart a course to that future and think about it as we develop spectrum policy.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think the, in the 6G, I was curious too, if in that context, if there are other policy implications. Like you said, if you have these sensors all around us, we're kind of embedded in this wireless world. And now we're saying, well, we're going to issue tons more spectrum for it and things like that. But are there other policy implications of these things? I mean, you mentioned the chips and security and things like that. But, you know, I saw a demo, for example, of, you know, reach out and touch. You can actually feel, right? You can feel the touch the other person through the airwaves, basically. I mean, not literally.
I think we're going to see opportunities with millimeter wave and terahertz frequencies that are going to be unique to that because they'll provide us with massive capacities.
Yeah.
I don't think that brings us ubiquity nationwide, but I do think that we have to start imagining what that future would look like and make sure that our spectrum policy serves it.
Yeah.
And you may be speaking to, there are, of course, a massive broader set of issues that come up in this new space, this new world that we're imagining, right? And you know, there are privacy issues, security issues. When you think about the ubiquity of sensing, the ubiquity of networking, the new uses, the new harms that we can all imagine. And so I think all of us, I think, are very optimistic about, consider myself an optimist about technology. I do think that there will be incredible innovations and huge opportunities for people, but we need to be clear-eyed about where the risks are going to be. And this is a spectrum conversation, but we need to be informed about where we're going.
Right. Yeah, I can't look at everything just in a vacuum like that. That's it. I guess, so back just to that more down-to-earth question, I guess. What about so
when we look at all talking about spectrum policy,
it's like spectrum
right?
policy. You know, so, that's right. So we're talking about all these different bands and there are existing users. There's licenses, unlicensed, and satellite and whatnot. Where are we at on thinking about, I guess, dynamic sharing? You mentioned the labs and things like that, but where, you know, is there, we did CBRS as a certain approach to sharing. Other bands, a different approach, you know, the classical coordination approach is another one, but is there any, what are the thoughts on that with all these new bands coming? Are we going to see the CBRS type of approach or the incumbent informing approach?
Where do you want to start there?
Sure. I mean, I guess I would say yes.
yes to all those.
Yeah, and I think we are also excited, for example, about some of the new sharing techniques. I see the incumbent informing capability seems like a very promising one to us, but and we're excited to do more work in that space. I think just generally feeling very optimistic about the opportunities and, you know, the need for sharing. So I think you'll see a pretty broad, a buffet of choices.
Yeah, I guess no, there's no two bands that are the same. I guess everyone has their own story and their own set of criteria.
But I do think it's important what you mentioned about the CBRS band. You know, it really broke this binary system that we had operated with in the United States for a long time, which is that you either had licensed airwaves or you had unlicensed airwaves.
Right.
And with the 3.5 gigahertz band, we mixed the two. And we created a different model and a different opportunity that incorporated some elements of licensed, some elements of unlicensed. And again, it's one of those ways in which the United States was creative and ahead of the rest of the world. And I think we should continue to study those bands for opportunities in other bands, particularly those that might have incumbents in them today. Because it's clear to me that if they've got occasional use, there are probably ways to optimize that use so they get what they need, but that we create commercial opportunities as well.
Okay, so still possible. We've heard for a number of years now, I guess, the possibility of using those techniques in other bands, but so far hasn't materialized. Right?
Well, there's certainly some structural challenges associated with them, you know, getting the incumbents comfortable, making sure you have the dynamic spectrum access systems that actually work for the frequencies at issue. There are also challenges under the Commercial Spectrum Enhancement Act to make sure that when we set up an auction, we develop a revenue that is 110% of their relocation costs,
right.
Which puts some constraints on how creative we can be. But I do think if you stand back and you squint, you realize that binary system of licensed versus unlicensed has been broken down by the CBRS initiative, and we should explore what that means going forward because it might create more opportunities for abundance.
Yeah, makes sense. So, that's excellent. I think there's a lot of interesting, there's so many points we could discuss, I guess. Let me come back to just one other one, because I know we're up against a time wall, I think, a little bit, but just one other thing. So one of the, I guess, the role of, if we could talk a bit about the role of wireless in universal broadband would be something. I guess, you know, if we look at fixed wireless access, it's sort of, a lot of people kind of quip that it's like the first killer app for 5G and things like that. But, you know, when you read the BEAD document, it says, no on wireless, right? So what can you, if you can give us a bit of,
well,
in the interest of time, it kind of compressed the conversation, but
I'll give a quick, very half step back just to say, you know, this is a historic moment. You know, we've been talking about the digital divide in this country for over 20 years, and we have finally been given, thanks to the bipartisan infrastructure law, other laws that have come before it, real serious resources to do something serious about closing the digital divide. Both of our agencies are playing major leading roles in realizing the president's vision for everyone to have access to high-speed, affordable, reliable internet service. And they keep saying everyone, so that makes me a little nervous. But this is historic, and we will be connecting people in ways that they've never been connected before. We fully believe that there are going to be a wide variety of approaches. NTI is administering nearly $50 billion of grants. $42 billion of that is in this state grant program, the BEAD program, as we call it. Based on the way that Congress wrote the law, based on our belief in the importance and extensibility of fiber, we do have a thumb on the scale to try and push fiber deployment as far out as possible into the country. But we fully expect that there are going to be other technologies deployed, and it's going to vary state by state. And I think you will see, we fully expect that there are going to be generous amounts of fixed wireless in this bundle. There will probably be satellite deployments in this. And our NOFOs clearly contemplated that. Mm-hmm. And I think also just the fiber deployment we expect will also facilitate and be really important in ultimately promoting a broader and healthier wireless ecosystem, mm-hmm. too.
And with 50 states, there does seem to be 50 different approaches to it.
There are going to have to be. Every state is, Rhode Island is radically different from Alaska and Montana, and we see it, and we fully expect that they will have really different approaches. And some of them really may be, fully fiber-oriented, and some of them we think are going to have very, very large mixes of technologies.
Sure. I mean, it just seems like there seems to be a lot of different views of that, which is good to hear your approach to it.
Yeah.
But, as to how the fixed wireless fits in, and I know some states are saying yes and some are saying no, and it's, when you read the NOFO,
Well, and I will say, I'll just say we have a massive incentive to make this work in the most cost-effective way possible,
yeah.
Just in the sense that $42 billion doesn't go as far as it used to, right? Or it doesn't go as far as you think it might. And it's not just our money. It's the money that the RDOF funding, the Affordable Connectivity Program, all of these fit together to realize this vision. And it is going to be a generational vision. I think generations before us brought, electricity and water to rural America. This is our generation's chance to build the things that people need to thrive in the modern economy, and that's going to be connectivity.
Okay, that makes sense. But I guess how does all this fit together then? Maybe we can get to that. Like, you've got the BEAD, and you've got the FCC did the RDOF. You've got the 5G fund, I guess, or the mobility fund, whatever the segues of those. How do these all kind of fit together?
So the stunning thing is that we came out of this pandemic, and I feel like Washington policymakers are more committed than ever before to closing the digital divide, and that's terrific. Congress also created more policies than we've ever had before to do that, and we're going to work to make sure that they all work together. That is not a simple task. It's not an easy one. I know for our part at the FCC, we have signed a memorandum of understanding with the NTIA, with our colleagues at the Rural Utilities Service, and with our colleagues at the Department of Treasury, because they too have funds to help address these issues. And I know we're trying to make those efforts meaningful every day. Everyone has different laws, different statutes that they have to be governed by, but we want to make sure that, as Alan suggested, his $42 billion go as far as possible, and also that our resources are deployed as smartly as possible in light of that.
Yeah. And I will just add, there is a lot, go back to coordination, there's a huge amount of coordination going on to make sure that's true at the staff level, making sure we're not duplicating when we do grants already in the grant programs where we're moving. We trying to cross-promote, right? Every speech I give on broadband, I'm talking about the Affordable Connectivity Program because it's news you can use today, and people are really excited about getting people connected to that program, and we've got millions who are eligible and should be on it. I think we are all working in lockstep right now, and probably we're got more coordination than maybe we sometimes even want.
Quite possibly, yes.
So the 5G fund or whatever is still an active file, I guess?
So the FCC has supported wireless in rural areas for mm-hmm. some time. It was an outgrowth of the Universal Service Fund from the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Mm-hmm. I think that if I have a desire going forward, it's that our efforts would be more data-driven, and that's why the work we're doing under the Broadband Data Act is so important. Because not only will it include information about where broadband is and is not all across the country that is wired, it will also include information about the state of wireless deployment. So we want to identify where we don't have signals, and we want to identify how, going forward, universal service funds can help assist to make sure there are fewer and fewer of those places around the country.
Okay. All right, so I think we have maybe a couple more minutes. I don't know if there's anything you want to wrap up with. You could give us a timing around the roadmap and the spectrum strategy or
something. Oh, we're working on it. We're working on it. Listen, I think we need a short term, identify some bands, and you know, I hope to be able to give NTIA some thoughts on that, but I think we're gonna also need a long-term effort to identify where we wanna go to 5G, 6G, and beyond.
We've talked about the National Spectrum Strategy. I think it's one of the next big things on our roadmap. It's a project that needs to pull in lots of people, lots of parts of the federal government, different federal agencies, but also folks in this room, right? Industry stakeholders, nonprofit stakeholders, the state and local communities. The benefit of a National Spectrum Strategy is that it's something that's informed by all the needs out there. So this is not we're going to write it in a room and drop it next month. This is going to be a multi-month effort with a lot of outreach. And we appreciate the chance to be part of that conversation with you all. And I will just say a personal note of appreciation to the chairwoman, Jessica. You've been an incredibly great partner for me in coming into this role, and I've learned a lot from you, and so it's great to be here out on the stump together talking about how we're working together.
I know, this is the first time that we've done this together.
This is. We're going to work on our jokes.
I know. Back and forth.
Back and forth.
No, I don't think we're inherently funny, so it's going to take some time.
I know.
Or we don't mean to be.
You're funny. You're funny.
I don't know what you mean by that, but anyway.
That was an incredible conversation, and as I did, I should have mentioned that at the beginning, this is the first time the two of them have had a chance to converse in this format in front of an audience, so we certainly appreciate that, and thank them both very much for taking the time in a very busy agenda, and we know you both have other things to get on with, but we've touched on so many topics. Fortunately, the rest of the day, we're gonna go into those in more depth, the spectrum strategy. We didn't talk about WRC, so future things coming up in the international framework, and we'll get into other things, network sharing and private networks and Wi-Fi and the rest of it. So. Thank you very much, and a big round of applause for our two panelists.